It's Friday, February 18th. This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Judy Campbell. President Clinton pressures Congress to pass a military aid package to Colombia to stem the drug trade, but critics say it could embroil the U.S. into that country's civil war. The Mormon Church organizes a campaign against gay rights that stretches from Utah all the way to California. A violent breakup of a dock worker strike in South Carolina colors tomorrow's Republican primary there, and stepped-up security at the nation's nuclear labs brings charges of racial discrimination and Big Brother tactics. President Clinton and the Pentagon are pressuring Congress to pass a $1.6 billion aid package for Colombia. Most of that aid would consist of military hardware and training for Colombian troops. Supporters call it an anti-narcotics program designed to help stop a huge increase in cocaine and heroin flowing out of Colombia. But critics say it's a thinly disguised counterinsurgency program that threatens to draw the United States into Colombia's 30-year-old civil war. Free Speech Radio's Chip Mitchell traveled to Colombia to speak with those who would be most affected by the escalation of armed violence.
Outside Colombia's environment ministry, members of the Embaracatillo indigenous group have painted their faces and bodies for a traditional dance. It's part of a protest by 200 Embaras camping in front of the building since December 14th, following a 500-mile march from the northern province of Cordoba, where a dam project is flooding their most fertile land. Elsewhere in Bogota, 10 people lie dead in La Picota Federal Prison following a shootout between inmates. Like the rest of the nation's overcrowded and wretched prison system, La Picota warehouses those who await trial alongside convicted criminals. There's nothing unusual about this February day in Bogota. Even in this city of 6 million people, there's no escaping a civil war that's killed more than 35,000 Colombians in the last decade and displaced about 5% of the nation's 38 million inhabitants. In the central city of Barranca Bermeja, more than 100 displaced peasants are trying to make do without shelter in an abandoned lot. They arrived January 17th after a five-mile walk from their fishing village on the lower Simitarra River, where they fled helicopter fire and bombs. One of their leaders, who, fearing for his safety, asked that his name not be used, described the violence.
En lo que sucedió con este último desplazamiento que hemos tenido es que la presencia de las enviadas.
What I witnessed in this latest displacement were forces sent as U.S. aid to the government. They fired on the civilian population, he says.
En la zona contra la población civil, especialmente de pescadores de la ribera del río.
Military attacks against alleged supporters of leftist guerrillas are just the beginning. A December report by Human Rights Watch blames most of the country's abuses on right-wing paramilitary groups. The paramilitary groups work on behalf of cattle ranchers, drug traffickers, oil companies, mining firms, and many others with an interest in acquiring land. Peasants flee amid threats, disappearances, assassinations, and massacres. Jorge Rojas, executive director of the Displacement Advisory Group, says the United States should hold up military aid until the Colombian government cleans up its act.
Los grupos paramilitares son la principal causa de desplazamiento forzado en Colombia.
Paramilitary groups are the principal cause of forced displacement in Colombia. And Rojas adds, we don't know of any actions by the military to stop these groups from committing the assassinations and massacres behind the displacements.
Presionando el desplazamiento forzado.
Marco Fidel Velasquez is a leader of hundreds of African descendants living in a soccer stadium in the northwestern city of Durbo since 1997, when army-backed paramilitary forces ran them off their land near the Pacific coast.
Nosotros oímos del marco del proyecto del Plan Colombia, el apoyo de Estados Unidos llevar a Colombia.
Increased U.S. military aid worries those of us who are displaced ethnic minorities. It's so much money, yet we don't see any resources, social justice, education, or health care. All we see is violence. What is Colombia doing with all these millions of dollars, he asks. It attacks the population with helicopters, and groups of military and paramilitary soldiers disappear people. And there's no justice, he says.
Vemos como los grupos militares paramilitares desaparecen gente. Y no hay justicia.
Washington already sends aid worth nearly $300 million a year to Colombia. Clinton's proposal would multiply this sum more than five times. Nearly 80% of the aid would go to the army. The second largest aid portion would send Black Hawk copters to accompany planes spraying an herbicide produced by St. Louis-based Monsanto onto fields of coca leaves and opium poppies, the raw materials for cocaine and heroin. But the U.S. aid targets only areas controlled by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. It would have little effect on the paramilitary groups, which control their own coca crops, as well as the country's major cocaine processing facilities and trafficking networks. Another potential problem is that only a fraction of the aid is slated for helping coca growers switch to alternative crops. It takes a half-hour boat ride from Barranca Bermeja down the Magdalena River, then a long drive on a bumpy dirt road to get to Gilberto Guerra's village. He's the spokesperson of the Cimitarra River Valley Peasant Association. His group is known for its independence from paramilitary groups and from the nation's second-largest guerrilla force, the 5,000-strong National Liberation Army, which vies to control the region.
Nosotros a nivel de asociación y mesa de trabajo permanente por el Magdalena Medio presentamos un documento integral.
We've offered an integrated proposal for economic development and human rights in the Middle Magdalena area, and another proposal for volunteer crop substitution in the Cimitarra Valley. But the United States has directly rejected these plans. They told us their aid was earmarked for coca fumigation, he says.
Iba a ser utilizada gran parte en la fumigación de cultivos y que no había otra posición. Eso.
Other economic proposals have met similar fates. This leaves advocates for the displaced frustrated that the lion's share of the $1.6 billion U.S. aid package is devoted to war helicopters. Maria Cristina Salazar is president of Colombia's Save the Children chapter.
The civil population, and especially children, will be made the victims of war. So we would ask, why not give all that money or some of that money for education purposes, for health services, to better the lives and the conditions of life of children in Colombia. This would be much better than giving more military aid.
In Colombia, I'm Chip Mitchell.
Human rights groups are accusing Mexican authorities of mistreating students arrested earlier this month for their involvement in a strike that shut down the National Autonomous University of Mexico for 9 months. 745 students and teachers were arrested in the crackdown. About 265 remain in jail, facing charges from theft to terrorism. Last week, about 100,000 people marched in Mexico City, demonstrating for the release of the prisoners. Free Speech Radio News' David Bacon has just returned from Mexico City. He says residents there are showing overwhelming support for the student strike.
In recent years, the International Monetary Fund has been putting a lot of pressure on the Mexican government to begin ending subsidies for all kinds of public services. And so one of the proposals that the government has had for some time now is essentially the privatization of education. So when the Mexican government proposed this tuition, 800 pesos a semester tuition, it was not just a violation of the Constitution, but it was also the first step down a slippery slope. And that's why the students protested and struck on the campus for 9 months, was because not only the actual amount of the tuition, which would begin to bar poor students from going to school at UNAM, but also because it opens the door to the wholesale privatization of education generally in Mexico.
Now, Mexico right now is in the middle of a pretty hot presidential campaign. How does this strike play into presidential politics?
Well, the reason I think why the Mexican government, the federal government, moved onto the campus has a great deal to do with the upcoming election. Mexico City has been governed by the left-wing Party for Democratic Revolution for the last 2 years. And Mexico as a country is governed by the Party of the Institutionalized Revolution, which has governed Mexico for 70 years. So these two parties are in opposition in the coming election, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas from the PRD and Francisco Labastida from the PRI. When the government decided to suppress the strike, it went to the mayor of Mexico City, a PRD mayor, Rosario Robles, and asked her to use the municipal police in Mexico City to come onto the campus and to arrest the striking students. And she refused, saying partly that it was a violation of the Mexican Constitution, which guarantees the autonomy of the university and says that police are not supposed to come onto the campus, and also saying that it was really unprincipled to arrest the students to begin with. So the federal government moved in and used its own police resources in order to do that. And in a way, the federal government is trying to say to the people of Mexico that the PRD is unable to govern Mexico City, that the Mexico City is falling into a state of chaos and social disorder, of which the strike is a symbol, according to the federal government. And therefore, in the election, in the national election, which is coming up this summer, the voters should vote for order and social order and a political party that's able to maintain social order. And so really there was a lot at stake beyond just the issues of the strike.
How is that playing in Mexico? How's it playing in Mexico City, and how's it playing in the rural areas?
Well, I think how it's playing in Mexico City is pretty amply demonstrated by 100,000 people going into the streets of Mexico City 3 days later. I think that this move has lost the PRI Mexico City, not that they were going to carry it to begin with, I think, but it certainly puts the seal of doom, if you want to say it, on the effort by the ruling PRI to get the votes of Mexico City residents, either to change the government of the city or to carry it in the upcoming national elections. But Mexico as a country outside of Mexico City is a lot more conservative. And so in a way, the PRI and the Mexican government is sort of playing to that section of Mexican society outside of Mexico City, you know, this more conservative section, saying if you're worried about what's happening in Mexico City and that it might spread into the countryside and upset the social order, well, make sure that you vote for the PRI in the coming election.
What next?
Well, it's one thing to arrest the students, 745 students, warrants out for another 400, charging 200 of them with terrorism. It's one thing to arrest the students. It's another thing to actually return to a state of normalcy at the university. And I think that that's going to be very difficult because, obviously, very few people in Mexico City feel that there's a normal situation at the university. So it's still going to be necessary to have some kind of process of dialogue in which the issues that underlie the strike get resolved.
David Bacon, thank you.
Thank you.
In a surprise referendum result in Zimbabwe early this week, a slim majority of voters have rejected President Robert Mugabe's proposed constitution, heralding a possible change in government. From neighboring South Africa, Patrick Bond filed this report.
This was the first national electoral defeat experienced by Mugabe and his Zimbabwe African National Union since liberation was won from colonial Rhodesians in 1980. The impulse came from a broad civil society coalition led by the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. Late last year, labor leader Morgan Tsvangirai launched the Movement for Democratic Change, a political party that now threatens to take majority control of parliament when elections are held in April. Presidential elections are not until 2002, suggesting the possibility of continued political turmoil in this country of 12 million people for many, many months to come. For southern Africans, this is an especially important development, for just north of Zimbabwe, in Zambia, trade unionist Frederick Chiluba took power after 27 years of nationalist rule in 1991, but then implemented even harsher anti-worker economic policies than his predecessor. And a similar conflict is emerging between trade unions and the nationalist government of South Africa, the African National Congress, which has also adopted so-called neoliberal free market policies since 1994. Thus, Zimbabwe represents Africa's first chance to establish a post-nationalist and post-neoliberal government. Tsvangirai's main platform is against corruption, but his trade union constituents and allies in leading non-governmental organizations, progressive churches, human rights groups, and community organizations also bitterly attack Mugabe's mismanagement of the Zimbabwe economy. For notwithstanding Mugabe's occasional anti-imperialist statements, his government spent the last decade implementing a disastrous structural adjustment program designed by the World Bank and IMF. The program decimated the country's once strong manufacturing base and amplified inequality to levels now amongst the world's worst. Mugabe's constitutional proposals would have given the presidency increased power. The question now is whether in the forthcoming election, the same voters translate their apparent disgust for Mugabe's rule into a mandate for different economic policies. But Mugabe cannot be counted out because this election has served as a wake-up call to his party. He has new intelligence about where in the country he's weak, and Mugabe's record of holding fair and free elections is miserable. But also uncertain at this stage is whether a more progressive economic turn would result from a Tsvangirai-led parliament, given the ongoing pressure on Zimbabwe from the IMF, World Bank, donor governments, and other international debt collectors, pressure for any Zimbabwe government to toe Washington's free market economic line. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Patrick Bond in Johannesburg, South Africa.
The state of Utah's Child and Family Services Department in November issued a policy allowing state adoptions only to married couples. Advocacy groups filed suit, saying the rights of gays, lesbians, and unmarried couples are being violated. Now the battle has moved to the state legislature, which is considering bills to make the policy state law. Alan Nauman reports from Salt Lake City.
Child advocates and gay and lesbian families spent Valentine's Day asking their legislators to open their hearts to the children of Utah who are waiting to be adopted. Proposed legislation in Utah would ban unmarried cohabitants in a sexual relationship from adopting children in Utah. College instructor Bradley Weishel spoke at a conference at the state capitol.
Our personal experience with our son speaks volumes to the absurdity of these bills. We are working daily to repair the damage of 9 years of neglect and abuse at the hands of a married couple, woefully inept at parenting. I urge my fellow Utahns to resist this ignorant, absurd effort to make unmarried couples second-class citizens, deemed unworthy of raising children.
Adoption attorney Laura Milliken Gray has finalized 18 adoptions by gay and lesbian couples over the last 2 years. Gray said the legislation will make her work illegal. She said such a measure is unconstitutional.
Children's rights to be placed with parents is going to be affected. Their constitutional right to not be treated differently as a class. Parents' rights to place their children with whom they want are going to be affected. These raise significant constitutional questions under both the Utah Constitution and the federal Constitution.
The bill's sponsor, Republican State Senator Howard Nielsen, says his measure won't take away any rights people have right now.
I firmly believe the adoptee, who is very vulnerable and needs the best environment he can get, needs both a father and a mother if it's possible. So they should have preference. And I think the father, they should be legally married. The man and woman living together without being in the clergy are not fit parents for adoption purposes. So I want to put them in the very best chance for the adoptee. And that's why my purpose of my bill. If the others want to have a custody, if there's a relative that wants to have custody in a homosexual pair, they can will that. They can say that if something happens to me, you can take care of my children. That's still possible. That doesn't take it right away. I do not regard it as a right. I think adoption is a very sacred thing. A child coming into a family is a very sacred event. I firmly believe that the husband and wife legally married is the best choice.
A similar measure was defeated last year in Texas, but most analysts believe the restrictions will find greener pastures in Utah. Analysts expect the bill to pass out of the state legislature and receive the governor's signature. Democrats hold only a third of the seats in both houses, and the state's governor, Mike Leavitt, is a Republican. Activists say they will go right into court the day after these bills pass. Stephen Clark is with Utah's ACLU.
It is horribly regressive legislation in terms of what the best practices and the policies are of child welfare organizations and states around the country. And that is increasingly to base the very difficult decision about where to place a child in foster care, to base those on the particularized circumstances and the best interests of the child on a case-by-case basis. What legislation like this does, and it's one of the very few regressive pieces of legislation in the country, is it substitutes the blanket judgments of politicians about what's in the best interest of children for the individualized case-by-case judgments of child welfare professionals and family court or juvenile court judges.
Many see the hand of the Mormon Church in Utah's push for tighter adoption restrictions. The church has become increasingly active in recent years, opposing gay rights measures across the country. The church has also lent its help to measures nationwide that ban same-sex marriage. The Mormon Church has been particularly active in California, where voters will go to the polls next month to vote on a ban on gay marriages, Proposition 22. At Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, the Mormon Church-owned university, students have been recruited and receiving college credit for helping in the campaign. The church also wrote a letter to all 700,000 of its members in California, imploring them to give money and time to the ballot campaign. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Alan Nauman in Salt Lake City.
A clash between unionized workers and police in Charleston, South Carolina, has become an issue in that state's Republican presidential primary. On January 20th, police confronted hundreds of workers during a protest against the use of non-union longshoremen to load a cargo ship. It turned into the most violent labor dispute on the Charleston waterfront since the late 1960s. Free Speech Radio's Mimi Rosenberg spoke with Longshore local president Kenneth Riley. She files this report.
Unions are very much in the news in the South Carolina Republican primary as Governor George Bush criticized Senator McCain for not taking a strong anti-union stand. The issue comes up in the midst of what George Bush terms the Charleston Union Riot. Charleston longshore workers, who are predominantly African American, clashed with hundreds of police and state troopers in riot gear. Armored police cars drove in and out of the terminal gates while a police helicopter hovered above the union protest against the use of non-union labor loading a cargo ship. At least six people were sent to the hospital with injuries, and eight workers were arrested on charges of inciting to riot. Now Longshoremen's local president, Kenneth Riley.
This marked the first time that in the 36 years since the container revolution that non-union workers were starting to handle containers. Prior to that night, on the first three incidents, there were only local law enforcement officers here. There was not one single incident that they could point to that would have warranted such a display of force. On that evening, we noticed all the armored vehicles and the prison buses and buses loaded with officers wearing riot gear started to assemble right down the street. And sure enough, that evening looked like the city was under siege. As the members started to make their way back to the Union Hall, they were being harassed in the street by police officers. They were set up in front of the building. They were intimidated, provoked. And I think when it finally said and done, you would see that the troopers themselves were the aggressor. When they got down there, it was the officers that started moving forward to push them back. Then some scuffle ensued, and then I got a call that someone was laying out there with the head busted open. And I made my way to the front line and started pushing our guys back, and we had already established a buffer between our guys and the front line of the patrolmen. All of a sudden, one of the officers came out of the line, clubbed me on the head, and as the guys started taking me out of there, because I could hardly see for the blood, that's when everything went haywire.
As a result of the longshoremen's union confrontation, new anti-union legislation is being proposed. I asked Kenneth Riley why the state of South Carolina chose this time to war against unions.
The order for this show of force came out of Columbia, our capital. When you see what has happened since that time, you know that we were singled out to be made an example, to let the world know that, and in their own words, that South Carolina is a strong right-to-work state. We intend to keep it a strong right-to-work state. We're going to pass more legislation to ensure that. Labor is definitely under attack here, because if we were not a threat, we wouldn't be under such attack. And I think we found the attack intensify. The more we bring our local into the mainstream of South Carolina politics, we are actually now starting to have an impact on certain races statewide. We are starting to network with all the other unions in the state. South Carolina is a Republican stronghold, so naturally now we have become a target of the Republican Party here in South Carolina.
Action produces reaction, and Kenneth Riley talks about workers' response to the union busting in South Carolina.
The positive thing about all of this is since this incident occurred, we have had more calls and requests for groups of workers wanting to organize because they see workers standing up, and they themselves know that they don't have that vehicle of coming together in their workplace and doing the exact same thing. Our guys here, even in this local, are becoming more motivated because in the past have been somewhat self-centered. We had a good job, and they were sort of complacent, but they themselves not recognizing the fact that it's more than that. We are involved in a movement. For them to have seen this struggle, it's raising a level of consciousness in the folks that I've seen. I think the South need to become a priority. The jobs are coming to the South, corporations are moving to the South, therefore more money and organizing need to be spent in the South. We have a massive task in educating workers in general.
This is Mimi Rosenberg for Free Speech Radio News.
Stepped-up security at the nation's nuclear labs brings charges of racial discrimination and Big Brother tactics. Asian employees say they're the victims of a witch hunt. Others say stepped-up security measures are violating their privacy rights and personal dignity. And to make matters worse, one of the Livermore Lab's leading scientists resigns, saying increased weapons production will bring Armageddon. Chrissy Clark reports from San Francisco.
A scientist in a gray suit, Dr. Tupadakis seems an unlikely nuclear activist. But after a year and a half of working in the Stockpile Stewardship Program on nuclear weapons maintenance, Tupadakis quit his job to join the peace movement. He made his position clear, saying, "Making weapons of mass destruction in the name of peace is nothing else but an act of murder waiting to happen." Tupadakis originally came to the lab to help dismantle nuclear weapons and dispose of their deadly byproducts. He said his conscience compelled him to resign when he realized the environmental work that he had expected to do at the lab was an illusion.
"I know from my experience that other people there are facing the same thing. They go with the belief that they will work in environmental positions or non-proliferation, budgets change, and they find themselves in places that they do not desire to be."
The public resignation of a scientist at the height of his career is unprecedented for the National Nuclear Weapons Program. For Tupadakis, the idea has been brewing. At a recent public hearing focused on the polygraph test that the lab had planned for thousands of their employees, Tupadakis made an emotionally charged statement about the condition of leadership at the lab.
"What is the management's position about polygraphy? Allows the DOA come in and put wires on the people's hands to see what they think, to read their thoughts. What does the management of Los Livermore National Laboratory has done about it to protect the employees and their rights? When I was hired, no one told me I will sit on a chair, put wires here on my hand to read my thoughts. And if I don't, then I will have to find a different job. That was one more reason to make up my mind to get out of this, to resign."
Workers of Asian and Pacific Islander descent are also uncomfortable with the lab's polygraph program. In the wake of the Wen-Ho Lee case, they feel the program can be used as a tool for racial profiling. Kalina Wong, a Chinese-Hawaiian nuclear accountability specialist, is one of nine Asian American lab employees who filed an employment discrimination complaint with the state of California last December. She says the fallout from the Lee case has touched her personally.
"I work in the nuclear materials field, which is the same as what Wen-Ho Lee worked in. And we have had tightened security, both on the computer use, which is where I primarily work, and in the actual handling of the material. Because of these tightening measures, there were certain things brought out, such as, I'm sure you heard of the polygraphing, that was required of people who are PAP. It's a special program, a personal assurances program, but it's really called the Human Reliability Program. And I was never a part of that. I never part of the Human Reliability Program. But now all of a sudden I'm required to be a part of it. And I'm the only one who's new that has to be on it."
Heightened concerns about racial profiling add to long-standing complaints that Asian Pacific Islander employees are paid less, are evaluated less favorably, and are offered fewer plum assignments than their white counterparts. According to Wong, the stressful atmosphere of discrimination interferes with the creativity that scientists need to do the kind of research and development work that is Livermore's specialty. While emphasizing that she and her colleagues enjoyed their field of expertise, Wong warned that if the discrimination problem is not resolved, government labs will face a brain drain.
"There is statistics showing that over 50%, or roughly 50%, let's say, of the people in graduate school are Asian Pacifics. So now, if we don't attract them to the government labs, who will we get? My daughter, an American of Asian descent, graduating with a degree in computing science, will not consider working at the labs because of the existing unfavorable working conditions."
Next week, San Francisco attorney Brad Yamauchi will turn the nine individual complaints into a class action on behalf of all the several hundred Asian Pacific Islanders working at Lawrence Livermore Lab. The administrative action is the first step to a lawsuit. I'm Chrissy Clark for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz and David Sears. Matt Martin is the distribution coordinator. Technical assistance from Leslie Holmes and Josh Thayer. The contributing reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line by filing for Free Speech Radio News. You can find out how to support them by calling 212-439-8087. That's 212-439-8087 or on the web at www.savepacifica.net/strike. Thanks to the National Radio Project for leasing us space. I'm Judy Campbell. Thanks for listening.